This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
My name is Jonathan Brown. I'm a professor at Georgetown University. And some of you I may have met before. I don't think I've met most of you. I think that actually, you know, Omid's talk and the video were very helpful in bringing up something I think is very important. And that's dealing with ideology in university life. Dr. Shikiti in the video talked about that academia is the universities are the battlegrounds of ideas and ideology. We all know what ideas are. You know, freedom is an idea. Justice is an idea. Macroeconomics is an idea. Development theory is an idea. Gender rights, these are ideas, okay? People can talk about ideas. People can learn ideas and manipulate them like toys or objects or Plato and in your mind and in your discussions. Ideology is much more complicated. What is ideology? Ideology is the background of your brain. Think about this. It's the way you see the world, and because it's the background against which you see the world, people aren't aware of their own ideologies until they are made aware of them. So an ideology is your worldview. It's a set of assumptions that you have that you learned when you were growing up from your family, from school, from the environment overall. And it's what you believe without even knowing you believe it. So what are certain, let's say, ideologies you might encounter in university? Ideology is... Universities are the most liberal part of the United States, the most liberal bastions in American culture. And therefore, the ideology that is predominant in universities is the ideology of liberalism. What is the ideology of liberalism? I call it Daily Show audience ideology. Right? I'm sure some of you have watched The Daily Show. Okay? What is the world of The Daily Show audience? What are the things that are assumed to be true? What are the things that you don't even have to prove because everybody knows they're true? This is what makes up an ideology. And as Muslims, it is very likely that you are not going to share in a lot of the elements of liberal ideology. And when you go into a university, that's going to become very quickly a conflict for you. This is what often happens to Muslims. And if they aren't aware that they're having a conflict of ideology, they don't know how to deal with that conflict. When you want to discuss ideologies, as I mentioned before, what it means is you're going to be discussing something with somebody that they are actually not really willing to discuss. It means that you're going to question assumptions that they have that they've never questioned before, that they don't want to question. And in one sense, universities are the ideal place to do that because the university is a place that encourages the life of the mind, in which you can sit and discuss things all the time, and that's what your main job is to do in university. But, like I said, you really get into kind of challenging someone's identity. And that can be really good for people. It was, for example, I was not Muslim when I started college, and then I became Muslim. That was a big change in my identity. So it's good, you can have good changes, but it doesn't happen without tension, it doesn't happen without confrontation. You just have to be aware of this. So what is, let's talk just a bit briefly about liberal ideology. We could have a long discussion about what liberalism is. But liberalism in general, you could say, is the idea that human beings should not be constrained in any way by tradition or by religion. That the only thing that should constrain us in public life, in our laws, in our public morality, in our politics, is a reason. That we will only discuss things with each other, only talk to one another in a public space in the language of reason, what is provable rationally, what is provable scientifically. And that people should not have their freedom constrained in any way by anything other than reason. And a lot of times in the United States and in the West, it's also this idea that you can do whatever you want as long as you don't hurt other people. You can do whatever you want as long as you don't hurt other people. Now, that's a very, very... very, very short, very almost amateur description of liberalism, but I think it gets at some important points. And I think that if you imagine kind of a Daily Show episode, and what the audience of a Daily Show, thinks, that can give you an idea of what liberalism is in its application. Now, it's an ideology because it's not aware of its own assumptions. When we talk about things like you are free to do whatever you want and as long as you don't hurt anyone else, or as long as you don't deprive anyone else of rights, there's a lot of assumptions in those sentences. One, it assumes we agree what hurting is. It seems we all agree on what it means to hurt somebody. That there are certain things that hurt people and there are certain things that don't hurt people. We can actually, if you get down to it, there's tons of disagreement about what hurt means, what harm means. Someone who's religious might think that harm is very different than someone who's not religious. Someone who's, you know, comes from a certain background might think harm is very different than someone who comes from another background. Second, you can do whatever you want as long as you don't infringe on other people's rights. What is a right? What are people's rights? And one of the core parts of liberal ideology in the United States and in the West is the notion of human rights. And human rights are the type of thing that if you really are going to have a very hard time challenging these in a university. Just get up and say, I don't believe in human rights, and see what happens to you. I mean, you're going to get people throwing tomatoes at you and stuff like that. It's a really controversial thing. But what makes something a human right? A human right is a right that people have by dint of being human. That means if you are a human being, you have these rights. That's what a human right is. Now, in the early days of the United Nations, it declared, I think it was 1948, it promulgated the UN Declaration of Human Rights. That actually lists a couple dozen rights that all human beings have, and they can't be deprived of, because they have these rights based on being human beings. Just to show you some of the intense internal assumptions and deep contradictions in such a declaration, or in such a document. The right number 19, declaration number 19, says that people should have the right to freedom of expression. You have the right to do things like express your opinion about Islam. You have the right to say what you think about the Prophet Muhammad. You have the right to talk about God. Right? These are all things that people do under the freedom of expression. And they don't have the right to be constrained. No one has the right to constrain them. However, if you look at Article 29 of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, it says that communities have the right to limit these other rights based on things like quote-unquote morality, quote-unquote public order. Now you see where the assumptions come in. What is morality? What is public order? In France, it's illegal to wear a veil, to wear a face veil. It's illegal to wear a hijab in school, because these are what? Threats to public order. They're threats to public order. In America, you can, I can go jogging down the street with my shirt off. And sometimes, if I've had an exceptionally long run for me, which is about 17 minutes, and I'm almost about to die of heat exhaustion, I will walk the last part back to my house with my shirt off. And I always think about myself, wow, how am I able to do this? But if a woman wanted to do that, what would happen? Any guess? If a woman just walked, she's running down the street, she's totally topless. She would get stopped, and the neighbors would call the police, a policeman would stop. She would be arrested for public indecency. Notions of what's indecent, what's immoral, what breaks public order. This is what I thought genders are supposed to be. You know, I thought we weren't supposed to have gender discrimination in this country. I thought that, you know, one of the things that's bad about Islam is that it says women have to cover up. They have to cover their bodies in ways that's wrong, that it's not fair. Why are we, if a woman goes to France, she can go to the beach topless. She can't do that in the United States. Is the United States violating her human right? No, because the United States is allowed to do this based on our notions of public order and morality. So you can see that there's so... The way human rights, even in their official formulation, there's always, culture always plays a role. Background assumptions always play a role. And this is the second really important point to keep in mind, which is that ideology is about power. Ideology is about power. It's about those who have power keeping it. It's about those who have power making other people who are challenged, who challenge them, bow down and submit. It's about making sure that other people shape their vision of the world to yours. That's the purpose of ideology. Okay, it is not neutral. And if you look at the world today, all you have to do is turn on the news for 10 minutes and you will have this slammed in your face multiple times. Why is it, for example, that in Egypt, a country where 80% or 85% of the women cover their heads, if Egypt were to pass a law that said women have to cover their hair, why is that a violation of human rights? While in the United States, all localities and states, or the mass majority, have laws that say women have to cover their upper bodies. Why is that? If you have a country where only 15% of the population wants to dress a certain way, wants to uncover their hair, and you have a democracy where the majority is able to pass legislation, why can you not have a law that is passed that says that women have to cover their hair? I'm not saying that they should do that or that's right. I'm just saying, if you believe in democracy, why is that unacceptable? It's unacceptable because according to Western culture, that's not how people dress. So telling other countries that they're violating women's human rights by making them wear hijab, that's us, that is the West saying, you have to accept Western norms of dress and Western lifestyle. And if you don't, then you're violating their human rights. Whereas let's say America became totally impoverished and France became the global superpower. They very well say to the United States, you are violating the human rights of women because you don't let them go to the beach or the pool topless. That seems ridiculous when I say that. But that's the whole point of ideology. Questioning it seems ridiculous. But that is precisely what I think Muslims should do. And they should do that not only because it protects our religion, it protects our worldview. It also makes other Americans come to terms with their own assumptions, their cultural assumptions. And that's something that Americans have to do if they're going to live in a country that is increasingly diverse, linguistically, religiously, racially. They have to be able to question their assumptions if the country is going to remain stable and prosperous. Other ways in which you can confront sort of liberal ideology. The idea that Muslims are violent. You know, you see on TV or professors will say, you know, the problem of Islamic terrorism, the problem of Islamic fundamentalism. Why do we even use these words? Do you know, so there's 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, give or take. Okay? Do you know what percentage of Muslims are terrorists? And that means if you take the biggest definition of terrorism, you include like all the Iraqi insurgents, you include the Taliban, all sorts of movements that are national resistance movements, you take all these groups, you take them all as terrorists, and you take the smallest estimate for the global Muslim population, do you know what percentage of Muslims are terrorists in the last 27 years? 0.006%. 0.006%. Do you know what percentage of American Muslims have engaged in terrorist actions? And I mean taking the broadest definition of terrorist action and the lowest estimate of number of American Muslims. Do you know what percentage? 0.0007%. 0.0007% of Muslims. And I'm just talking people who have been convicted of terrorism. They might even be innocent. And even things like, you know, material support for terrorism. All the biggest definition for terrorism. So how on earth do we talk about linking Islam and terrorism when 0.006% of Muslims are terrorists? How on earth could you talk about that? In addition, between 1980 and 2005, do you know what percentage of terrorist attacks in the U.S. were done by Muslims? 6%. Do you know what percentage were done by Jews? 7%. So what? This is between 2007 or 2005 and 2009 in Europe. 99.6% of terrorist attacks were not done by Muslims in Europe. And yet, when we talk about violence and religion, when you talk about terrorism, the first thing people talk about is Islam. That's ideology. because it has people associating things that in no way should be associated if you were just to look at the world through any empirical lens. You are more likely to find a criminal if you just go up to an adult male in America than if you go up to a Muslim. People will say things like, "Why you hear this all the time? Why don't Muslims condemn extremism? Where are all the moderate Muslims?" This is absolutely absurd. First of all, I've never met a Muslim who supports terrorism. I've only met maybe a couple hundred, couple thousand Muslims in my life, but I've never met anyone who was like, "Yeah, I love ISIS. Yeah, I love Al-Qaeda. These guys are great." You know, I've never met someone who says this stuff. Muslims trip over themselves to condemn terrorism. If you go to the website of Professor, UNC, Charles Kurzman, he has a whole list of all the groups that condemn 9/11. The Iranian government, Hamas condemned 9/11, Hezbollah condemned 9/11, the Saudi Mufti condemned 9/11, Yusuf al-Dawi condemned 9/11. Everybody condemned 9/11. And yet, people really believe that Muslims support terrorism. And if you, what I encourage you to do is, well, first of all, I would recommend getting in the book called Who Speaks for Islam by John Esposito and Dalia Mugahed, which is based on Gallup polling information. And you really have material you can just, people can't deal with. They can't challenge it. For example, according to Gallup polling, only 2% of the Iranian population agrees that attacks on civilians can be completely justified. 2% of the Iranian population. 4% of the Saudi population believes that, quote, attacks on civilians can be completely justified. 6% of the American population believes that attacks on civilians can be completely justified. So Americans are three times as likely as Iranians to believe that attacks on civilian populations are completely justified. So who is the problem with terrorism? This is the kind of questions. When you confront people with this information, they will be very upset. They will not know how to deal with it. They'll probably get angry and walk away. Because you've challenged basic premises in their ideology. But this is what I think Muslims have to do in this country. Because Americans can't be lazy like this. We can't be intellectually lazy. Because it's not going to help anybody. It doesn't make good policy. Things like, you turn on the news today and talking about ISIS and killing Yazidis and killing Christians, and people say, "Look at Muslims, look at Islam, it's so violent. Well, why does Islam teach this thing?" You say, "No, Islam doesn't teach it." "Well, why do I always see it on the news?" What I would ask is, wait a second, if Muslims are so violent, you know, okay, I condemn ISIS, I condemn these actions, I don't believe any civilians should be killed, I don't believe any human should be killed because of their religion, but Yazidis and Christians were in Iraq for 1,400 years and nothing happened to them. So the very fact that now it's in the news, you have to explain to me, if Islam's really so violent, why were they happy living there for all these centuries and with no news? No one asked that question. They ask you to explain why it's happening now. They don't bother to ask why it never happened before.
That's true.
Yeah. When people talk about, always be ready to ask these questions. And I find that often the most useful thing is not to make statements, not to attack somebody, but to ask them questions. You know, they ask you about why is ISIS doing this? Why does Islam teach these kind of things? You say, "Well, why have we never heard of this happening before in Iraq?" Or they ask about, why does Osama bin Laden think it's okay to attack the United States? Why does he think it's okay to kill civilians? And you'll say, "Well, it's really interesting, because in Islam you're not allowed to kill civilians." But Osama bin Laden's justification was not Islamic. Actually, he said the reason why American civilians are free game is because America is a democracy and they voted for the presidents who enacted the policies that Osama bin Laden didn't like. So Americans are free game not because of an Islamic argument, because of a democratic argument. And then you ask them, where I saw this argument used recently? Israeli generals talking about Gaza. Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard Law professor, explaining why it's acceptable for Israel to bomb Gaza bottom civilian population of Gaza. Why? Because they voted for Hamas. Therefore, they are fair game.
So they're using the
exact same argument. This is not an Islamic argument. This is an extremist argument. So you have to be aware of what, when people, a great example of ideology is that, you know, Islam has a problem with freedom of speech. Islam's limiting freedom of speech. When the Danish cartoons were posted, published, and when Charlie Hebdo in France published pictures making fun of the Prophet, Muslims violently reacted. Why can't Muslims behave themselves? Why don't they act civilized, understand that there's freedom of expression in the world? Do you know, it's very, if you are up for it's a very good book, but the author is very intelligent, and although the writing is clear, it asks you to be intelligent too. I recommend this book. It's fantastic. It's called On the Muslim Question by Ann Norton, N-O-R-T-O-N. I recommend this book. It's one of the best books I've read in the last couple of years, period. And she takes every issue and just demonstrates how over and over again, discourse about Muslims in the West isn't really about Muslims, it's about the West. It shows you the assumptions of the West, not anything wrong with Muslims. When the Danish cartoons, when the whole Danish cartoon crisis started, when a Danish, a children's book author wanted pictures of the Prophet for his children's book, he couldn't find any. So he wrote into this newspaper talking about that. The newspaper, Jyllands-Posten, put out an ad saying, we want people to draw pictures of the Prophet. They got lots of drawings. But they didn't want just any pictures. They wanted offensive pictures. So they only took the offensive pictures. Then they published them. Did the Muslim population in Denmark react? No. They got a few letters to the editor, angry letters to the editor. That's it from Muslims. They took, the Jyllands-Posten people took the cartoons to the imams of local mosques and showed it to them. They shoved it in their face. Say, look at this, imam. What do you think of this? Still, Danish Muslim population didn't react, except by the way they're supposed to. They wrote letters. They expressed themselves verbally. They weren't violent in any way. No one was harmed in Denmark. It was only when the imams from Denmark met at the Organization of Islamic Cooperation meeting months later in Mecca, and they brought actually a whole bunch of material, Islamophobic material, that had been, you know, graffiti, other cartoons, and they showed, look at the problem we have in Europe with Islamophobia. That's when Danish cartoons became a big issue. And where was the violence? Not in Europe. It was in countries like Nigeria, Pakistan, Syria. Countries that have their own history of violent protests. You didn't have violence in Europe. Muslim populations didn't go and burn things down. So where precisely is, you know, where is Muslims' hostility to freedom of speech? Second of all, if you look at these countries like France, Belgium, Denmark, it's illegal to question the Holocaust. I mean, it's illegal to even talk about the number of people who were killed in the Holocaust. It's illegal. It's illegal to print or distribute Nazi propaganda, any Nazi paraphernalia. It's illegal to engage in hate speech, in speech that incites violence. So actually, if you look at, this gets back to that, you know, Article 29 of the UN Declaration of Human Rights. You can limit rights to expression if it's important for protecting morality and public order. There's lots of things you cannot say and you cannot print in Europe because these things are illegal. It just happens to be that insulting the Prophet's not one of them. And instead of talking about greater issues of freedom of speech in a political community, or freedom of speech in a country like France where you have, you know, 7% of the population North African, or Germany where you have 5% of the population Turkish Muslims. Instead of talking about how does a community that is changing demographically and religiously deal with freedom of expression and the sensitivities of these communities, how do Europeans, quote-unquote, stand up courageously for freedom of speech? By insulting this tiny little minority. This minority that's already oppressed, that's already marginalized in their countries, getting up and standing and insulting their prophet. That's an act of courage. What about talking about things, seeing whether or not you can criticize Israeli policies? Right? Whether or not you can have a protest for Gaza. In the UK, these protests get broken up. In France, they've become illegal. Right? What about freedom of speech? What about freedom of expression? On cheap issues with, like, insulting the prophet. Suddenly, freedom of speech is important. On issues like talking about real justice and thousands of civilians being killed, suddenly freedom of speech just disappears. So these are the kind of ways I encourage you to think about the question of ideology in university life. University life is a battleground of ideas. It's a battleground of ideology. And by bringing people's ideologies to light, by asking them to confront and understand their own ideologies, you're not only doing your duty as a Muslim. I think you're doing your duty as an American because you're helping a country become more plural. Thanks very much.